There's people coming on with stolen passports, of course. That's one of the things which has people baffled. But then that could just as easily be a coincidence, and we really don't know that that's connected. It turns out, something we didn't know, that it's quite common for people to fly with stolen passports across Asia. And actually, Interpol have a huge database of stolen passports, 39 million of them. But immigration officials almost never bother to check against that database. That's something I didn't know, but doesn't make me particularly confident about flying across the region. But yeah, I mean, really, pretty much anything's up for grabs. I mean, Chinese relatives of the people on board the plane claim that they phoned, they actually got through to mobile phones of their relatives after the plane had disappeared, and the phones rang. Presumably, that's a telecom. That's some kind of telecoms glitch or some kind of telecoms fault. But in the state we're in now, where nobody knows anything, it's not surprising those relatives were sort of clinging to that straw and actually quite angry yesterday and today that the authorities didn't appear to have taken them very seriously.
Simon, you're in Beijing for the Washington Post. Can you explain what the response has been from Chinese officials? Because they've most recently, it seems, they're asking Malaysia to intensify the search efforts, right?
The initial kind of mood that was coming out of all of the Asian countries is we're all in this together, but that's kind of given way a little bit, to be honest. The Chinese have starting to sound increasingly peeved at the Malaysians for not having found the plane. They're under pressure themselves, of course. I mean, the relatives are not just... The relatives are pretty angry with everybody. They were throwing water bottles at Malaysian airline officials both yesterday and today. But they were also shouting and screaming at the Chinese officials for not having done more, for not having visited them before, for not having given them more information. So the Chinese government feels under a certain amount of pressure with, you know, a large percentage of the passengers on the board the plane coming from China. They feel under pressure. They're transferring some of that pressure to Malaysia and sounding a little bit frustrated with the Malaysians.
Simon Drainer in Beijing.
Hundreds of concerned citizens gathered in Portland's Pioneer Square in the pouring rain on Saturday to send a message to Governor John Kitzhaber to stop the planned coal export facilities on the Columbia River. Children and adults worried about health issues, air and water pollution, and climate change gave personal testimonies from a small stage. Daydell Quest and Maya Bolte were two of the speakers at the rally on Saturday.
I am thankful that you are all here today because you are being responsible with my future. I am here today to talk to you about how to change the world, because as much as people might tell you otherwise, together we can change the world. Right now, the world is being destroyed and my future is looking bleak. If we do not stop projects like these coal exports, and if we do not tell our governor to deny the permits, our world will become a flat, barren island. Our precious gorge will become a highway for dirty, coal-driven money at the expense of your children's quality of life. My quality of life. I started being interested in climate change when I heard on the radio that the world's future was looking rough. I was only 4, but I could tell something that was really wrong and that something needed to happen. I decided it was more important to try and fix the problem than to be scared of it. Over the past few years, I have learned that fear is based on wanting to hide yourself. Fear comes from feeling that you are powerless. I am here today to tell you that you are powerful beyond measure, that your voice is more powerful than any other. It not only has the ability to change the world, it is the only thing that ever will. Coal companies may tell us that we are weak and unable to fight the power of the corporate greed, but when shall we be stronger? Will it be tomorrow? Will it be next week or in a few years? Will it be when our sacred river is polluted with coal dust to the point there are no more salmon? Will it be when our planet is so warm it no longer supports the glaciers? Will it be when the parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere is over 450? Will it be when all the coal is ripped off every mountaintop and all the oil is drugged from every pristine place beneath our feet? It is our future, Mr. Governor, and it is time to act upon the voices of Oregonians and deny the permits for these coal companies.
I'm Mia Bolte. I'm 13 and in the 8th grade at Sunnyside Environmental School. For quite a while now, we have been learning about coal exports through the U.S. and Oregon. So most of us, including me, have come to the conclusion that coal is a horrible way to produce energy, and if we use coal to power our society when we run out, or before then, our society will deteriorate. Some may argue that coal creates jobs and energy, but so does renewable green sources like hydro, wind, and solar power. And the effect of coal is too great. For example, if this proposal goes through, various coal companies will ship 150 or more million tons of coal through Oregon and Washington per year. That's enough to fill over 10,000 trains a year that are over a mile long. Coal has dozens of chemicals in it that are toxic to humans and animals in our climate, including mercury, nitrogen oxides, and sulfur dioxide. The coal train would be going along the Columbia River, and when the mercury in the coal dust gets into the water, it will also be ingested into the salmon, which we eat, therefore getting into our systems. Coal dust, if breathed in, can worsen asthma, cause emphysema, and even lung cancer. And 500 pounds of coal dust are lost in transport per car per 500 miles. There are 125 to 150 cars per train, so that's 62,500 to 75,000 pounds of coal dust per train for 500 miles, or 125 pounds to 150 pounds of coal dust per train per mile. The trains are over a mile long and would be crossing public street level crosswalks in Portland. It's not just transport of coal that is harmful to us, our environment, and animals. The mining of coal destroys mountains and releases tons of coal dust to settle over small towns. And not to mention the burning of coal that releases huge amounts of CO2 in air, which causes climate change. CO2 is the thing that causes climate change. So, Governor Kitzhaber, listen to what we have to say and make the right decision not to sign any more permits to allow the coal train plan to go through. Because you're supposed to do what's right for us and our community and show us that you care. Because when my school went to the governor's office last year to deliver hundreds of Valentines against coal exports in honor of Oregon's 154th birthday, you ignored us. And when we had our energy teach-in last year, and my school sent you dozens of letters that were pages long against coal exports, you didn't acknowledge us again. And Subkins wrote to Obama and they got letters back acknowledging them. So please, Governor Kitzhaber, think of us now and make the right decision. Thank you.
Those were the voices of young Portlanders Day Delquist and Maya Bolte. They spoke at Saturday's rally against coal exports at Pioneer Courthouse in Portland. Speakers prodded the governor to, quote, save us from coal. Some held handmade signs reading, quote, there are no jobs on a poisoned planet. The planned Amber Energy coal terminus at Boardman would bring hundreds of train cars carrying coal every day from Montana to the Columbia River Gorge, where the coal would be put on barges to the coast for export. Protesters say the state of Oregon would not benefit financially from the coal transport, but would suffer the risks and damage that goes along with the transportation of coal.
Immigrant detainees at a Washington State detention facility are on the fourth day of a hunger strike. The detainees at the Northwest Detention Center began refusing food on Friday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials said that they believe 750 prisoners are now on the hunger strike. The Northwest Detention Center is operated by a private prison corporation, GEO Group, and houses 1,300 detainees who are in deportation proceedings. Detainees are protesting the record number of deportations of undocumented immigrants. The Obama administration has authorized over 2 million deportations since 2009. This is more than all other previous presidents combined. At the Washington facility today, approximately 20 prisoners were moved into a small seclusion cell and not allowed access to a bathroom, according to the wife of one detainee. Advocates say the move is in retaliation for those detainees leading the strike. The Washington Post found substandard living conditions and numerous suspicious deaths in immigration detention around the country in a period between 2003 and 2008. Around 34,000 non-citizen detainees are being held in the United States, about two-thirds of whom are held in private immigration detention.
More than 100 protesters marched in downtown Portland this morning to mark the 55th anniversary of Tibet's failed uprising against Chinese rule. Mayor Charlie Hales addressed the crowd at City Hall, where the march began and ended. March 10th is observed by many Tibetan exiles as Tibetan Uprising Day and is considered the beginning of the Chinese occupation of that region. Similar marches were held in many U.S. cities to mark the occasion, and in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, 9 exiled Tibetans were arrested during a crackdown against a large protest in front of the Chinese embassy. The Tibetan uprising began in 1959 against what people saw as an occupation of the region by the Communist Party of China, which had been ongoing since China's invasion and annexation of Tibet in 1950. The uprising resulted in the flight of the 14th and current Dalai Lama from the country and several years of guerrilla warfare, including Tibetan agents trained by the CIA. It is estimated that 87,000 Tibetans died in the conflict, and considerable damage was caused to monasteries, temples, and the capital of Lhasa. China encourages the celebration of March 28th as Serfs Emancipation Day, marking the day the Tibetan government was declared illegal by China in 1959. The Dalai Lama and others have criticized this holiday as a distraction from the persistent problems faced by the Tibetan people, which are still the cause of protests and unrest in the region. Since 2009 alone, 127 Tibetans have set themselves on fire to protest China's policies in Tibet, which have resulted in political repression, environmental degradation, displacement, ethnic discrimination, and economic depression.
The city of Eugene, Oregon, has become the first municipality in the United States to ban a type of pesticide that has been linked to bee deaths. For more, I spoke with local beekeeper Jen Davis.
Today I'm speaking with Jen Davis. She is the originator of Bee Friendly Portland. That's Bee with B-E-E, Bee Friendly Portland, a group that works on a neighborhood level to educate people on ways to sustain and protect our pollinators. Recently, Eugene, Oregon City Council passed Resolution 5101 that bans the use of neonicotinoids on city properties. Jen, can you tell us some more about this, and are there other cities in the U.S. that have passed bans on neonics?
Sure. Neonicotinoid pesticides are a class of pesticide that are a synthetic form of nicotine. What we are seeing is that it has extremely toxicological effects, according to over 100 independent studies on the safety of bees. It's a neurotoxin for bees. It confuses them. They can't remember where their forage is. They can't remember how to find their way home, hence the association with colony collapse disorder. They're less able to communicate. We're aware of the exquisite bee dance where bees are able to express to each other by a very specific dance where the location of pollen is. This disrupts their ability to communicate. And they've also found that by bringing pollen and nectar home from neonicotinoid-treated plants, that also can disrupt the queen's ability to reproduce. Neonicotinoid pesticides are particularly toxic because they are a systemic pesticide. That's a new kind of pesticide that you don't just spray on a plant and eventually it biodegrades or it washes away. It's actually taken up, it's water soluble, it's taken up into the plant system and then expressed in every cell of the plant, including the pollen and nectar. And so that's what makes this particular pesticide even more problematic, as well as the fact that scientists have found that this pesticide can remain in the plant and in the soil around the plant for many years, sometimes up to as long as 10 years. So you're getting something that is continually being a toxic presence for our pollinators, and is significantly concerning. As far as this ban, this is the first ban on the use of neonicotinoid pesticides on city property in the United States, and it's very exciting. Neonicotinoid pesticides are actually the most prevalently used pesticides now in the United States. And when you go to your garden center, a large number of those pesticides that you're going to see on the shelves do contain neonicotinoids now. And so it's been extremely difficult to control the use and prevalence of this extremely bee-toxic pesticide in our environment.
Are there other countries that have bans on neonicotinoids?
Yes, absolutely. The pesticide itself, neonicotinoid imidacloprid, has been created and manufactured by Bayer, which is a German company. But in 2008, there was such a huge bee loss, just really catastrophic. About 50 to 60% of all the bees in Germany died after the use of imidacloprid on sunflower crops, that they have banned the use of neonicotinoids in Germany, also in France and Slovenia and Italy and other countries. Italian farmers actually went on hunger strike to ban neonicotinoids because they were able to associate such heavy losses of bees with these pesticides.
I have a feeling that we're going to be doing a lot more stories on this particular issue and all the different implications that come from it. I would like to mention that in addition to being the founder of Bee Friendly Portland, Jen Davis is also a board member here at KBOO Radio. You can go to her Facebook page for Bee Friendly Portland, and that's B-E-E, Bee Friendly Portland, and learn more about what you can do to help with the situation. For KBOO Evening News, this is Rosalind Scott.
Backers of the ballot initiative to create a new Portland Public Water District held a public information session last week. Chief petitioners Kent Crayford and Floyd Jones highlighted problems with the Portland Water Bureau, including diminished control over Bull Run, the plan of destroying the existing reservoirs, and proposals to blend Bull Run water with Willamette River water. Opponents of the citizen initiative were also invited and handed out flyers warning that it was a Bull Run takeover and might harm the environment. Crayford and Jones then presented the main effects of the measure, including prohibiting the spending of water and sewer funds on unrelated projects, requiring an annual independent financial audit, and enshrining protections for Bull Run in the city charter. Portlanders will vote on the initiative in the spring primary, with ballots going out at the end of April.
Over the last year, more people have been using public transportation in the United States than any year since 1956. The American Public Transit Association released a report showing that people are traveling by bus, train, and tram more than at any time in the last 50 years. The report notes that Americans are expanding their transportation options, citing increased bus and train networks. Public transport now accounts for 1 in 3 trips nationally. But local transit provider TriMet has managed to go against the national trend with a 6% drop in ridership over the last year. 20 years ago, TriMet was considered the gold standard in public transportation. But with high administrative costs, the end of the free transit zone in downtown Portland, and cuts in service, TriMet's reputation has declined.
Workers at a Portland call center run by the Fund for the Public Interest finally have a union contract 2 years and 4 months after joining Communications Workers of America. Current and former workers at the Fund for Public Interest Portland call center staged a short strike and protest in October, which marked the 2-year anniversary of their vote to unionize. Protesters marched outside the headquarters of Osberg, which is one of the nonprofit groups that the call center workers raise money for. Fund for the Public Interest is headquartered in Boston. It runs door-to-door and telephone fundraising for state public interest research groups like Osberg. In spite of those groups' progressive reputation, workers say that the fund is an abusive employer which frequently lays off employees when they do not meet their quotas. The union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board that managers fired workers for trivial offenses. The fund fired the worker who first called the union, all 8 of the workers who presented the original union petition to a manager, all 4 workers who volunteered on the union's initial bargaining team, and several who replaced them. In February, the fund dropped its hard line on the requirement to pay union dues. Call center workers ratified a new 4-year agreement February 25th in a unanimous vote. The contract contains no raises or additional benefits, but it codifies existing workplace policies and addresses worker concerns about pay instability and job security.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Democrats on the U.S. House Committee dealing with labor laws are examining the business and labor practices at fast food chains that have full-time workers in need of public assistance programs. Representatives George Miller and Joe Courtney have sent letters to fast food CEOs at McDonald's, Burger King, Yum Brands, Wendy's, and Papa John's, outlining the growing concerns about their labor practices. The members of Congress want detailed information about the business models and labor practices at five of the nation's largest fast food companies. Representative Miller and Courtney say that the letters are the result of growing concern that the fast food labor practices are helping to drive up inequality, to stymie economic growth, and to strain state and local finances. Wage theft in the fast food industry is also an issue that the congressmen are concerned about. A Southern Union organizing effort is underway in Mobile, Alabama at the Austal USA shipyard. A business boom at the shipyard and a demand for highly skilled workers from around the country could be an organizing opportunity for unions. Ron Ault, president of the AFL-CIO's Metal Trades Department, told Working in These Times that the six unions in the department are banding together in an organizing campaign at Austal USA. The Australian-owned Austal is a contractor for the U.S. Navy. Austal is hostile to unions and uses anti-union meetings to instill fear in workers there. While the South is generally hostile to unions, a nearby shipyard in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is union with 6,000 workers. The Legislative Conference of America's Building Trades Unions is underway in Washington. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey said in his keynote speech that the one impression he strives to leave with union members, building trades leaders, and heads of industry is that today's building trades unions are change agents that are about cooperation, not conflict. McGarvey says the building trades unions are about collaboration and not division. He says the building trades unions have strong and proud traditions and values about protecting the interests of their members, their families, and the American middle class. A mediation tentative labor agreement has been reached for 200 flight attendants at U.S. Airways Express. Piedmont Airlines flight attendants, represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the tentative agreement with management includes economic improvements, better work rules, and other benefits for the regional flight attendants. The union says Piedmont flight attendants stayed united to get to the agreement reached with the help of the National Mediation Board. The ratification vote for the flight attendants starts March 17th and runs through April 9th. A new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research looks at the rights and limitations on public sector collective bargaining in the 50 U.S. states. The report focuses on teachers, police, and firefighters. It examines whether the workers have the right to bargain collectively, whether that right includes the ability to bargain over wages, and whether public sector workers have the right to strike. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Sadia Khan after this newscast. Then Labor Radio at 6, Prison Pipeline at 6:30, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather forecast calls for a 40% chance of showers, mainly before 8 p.m., patchy fog after 11 p.m., otherwise partly cloudy with a low around 37. Tomorrow, expect areas of fog before 11 a.m., later, partly sunny, then gradually becoming sunny, with a high near 58. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in North Portland, Powell Butte measures 27 cpm, in Vancouver, Washington, the radiation count is 23 cpm, Hanford, Washington has a 29 counts per minute count. EPA alert levels start at 100 cpm. More information on radiation counts, including the meaning of counts per minute, can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:29. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In Frank Baum's novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the wizard turns out to be a phony, just an old guy sitting behind a curtain, using his booming voice to spew nonsense in a vain effort to fool people. But now, a century after Baum's fictional Oz, A real-life incarnation of the phony wizard has been discovered, hiding behind not one, but two curtains. He's recently been booming out his nonsense in full-page newspaper ads that are hyperbolic screeds against economists who favor raising the minimum wage, denouncing them as radical researchers. The ad directs readers to a website named minimumwage.com, implying that it's the site of independent, unbiased, non-radical economists. But no, it's not a group at all, just a curtain. Who's behind it? Something that goes by the name of the Employment Policies Institute, which sounds rock solid, but it, too, is just a curtain. Go to 1090 Vermont Avenue in Washington, the address of this institute, and you won't find any economist or any other employee, for the institute has none. But you will find the old wizard sitting there, manipulating statistics, twisting logic, and spewing out economic nonsense. The whiz turns out to be nothing but a 71-year-old PR and advertising hatchet man named Richard Berman. Various corporations pay him to set up official-sounding front groups that advance their political agenda. The Employment Policy Institute, for example, is a front for the big restaurant chains. They want to keep profiting by paying poverty wages to their workers, so they've hired Berman to trash any and all who support raising America's wage floor. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Institute provides a varnish of academic legitimacy for unvarnished corporate greed. As the watchdog group PR Watch says of Berman's flimflam, they are little more than phony experts on retainer.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden spoke via video conference today at the South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas. Snowden is in Russia, where he sought asylum after leaking thousands of classified documents last year, revealing the widespread surveillance carried out by the National Security Agency against U.S. and foreign citizens. Here's a clip from Snowden's talk at the Media and Technology Conference today.
The NSA, the sort of global mass surveillance that's occurring in all of these countries, not just the U.S., and it's important to remember that this is a global issue, they're setting fire to the future of the Internet. And the people who are in this room now, you guys are all the firefighters. When you are the country, the one country in the world who has sort of a vault that's more full than anyone else's, it doesn't make any sense for you to be attacking all day and never defending your full vault. If data is being clandestinely acquired and the public doesn't have any way to review it, and it's not legislatively authorized, it's not reviewed by courts, it's not consonant with our Constitution, that's a problem.
That was NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden speaking at the South by Southwest Media and Technology Conference today. He spoke via teleconference to thousands of people attending the conference in Austin, Texas.
The most notorious Bitcoin exchange website, Mt. Gox, has filed for bankruptcy in the United States today. A federal court in Dallas granted the request today, temporarily halting federal civil proceedings against the site, a move critics say is a ruse to cover up fraud on behalf of the shuttered website. Mt. Gox was the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world, allowing users to exchange legal currency for Bitcoin, the nearly anonymous digital cryptocurrency favored by some civil libertarians. However, last month, Mt. Gox abruptly closed down, saying its network had been compromised and that 850,000 bitcoins were lost to hackers, according to Mt. Gox CEO Mark Karpeles in a bankruptcy filing in Japan where the site is based. The value of the lost bitcoins was reported at $474 million. The site also lost $23 million of customer assets as well. This weekend, hackers took over Karpeles' personal blog, accusing him of fraud.
The former Marxist revolutionary running for president in El Salvador has declared victory in the nation's presidential election. But the opposition has demanded a vote recount, saying the results were too close to call. Preliminary results suggest left-wing candidate Salvador Sanchez Cerón has a lead of 22 percentage points over his conservative rival, Norman Quijano. The Supreme Electoral Tribunal asked the candidates to refrain from claiming victory, which they had both done on Sunday. El Salvador remains deeply divided 22 years after the end of its civil war. The head of elections said there were, quote, discrepancies in the tallies of 14 ballot boxes, which would be reviewed. It could take until Thursday to confirm the official results.
3 years ago this month, an earthquake and tsunami damaged a nuclear facility in Fukushima, Japan. Nuclear safety issues in the United States and Japan persist. KBOO's Terry Eaton and David Lang spoke with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear.
The world saw on live television 3 years ago what these reactors are capable of. All it takes is a loss of the primary electric grid and the emergency backup power. So at Fukushima, Japan, it took an earthquake to take down the primary electric grid. It took a tsunami to take down the emergency diesels. But something like that could happen in the United States. So, for example, we have dozens of reactors here. Some of them are identical to the Fukushima reactors, which are downstream of major dams. So if those dams were to fail, you could lose both sources of electricity to run the safety and cooling systems, and it would be a very similar situation to Fukushima Daiichi.
There are similar reactors in the U.S.
Not only Fukushima twins, but, you know, other reactor designs as well have their own pathways to disaster. So whether it's a boiling water reactor or a pressurized water reactor. And in fact, the worst risk of an earthquake at a U.S. nuclear power plant is Indian Point, very near to New York City. Different design, it's a pressurized water reactor. But it turns out that they didn't know about earthquake fault lines in the vicinity of Indian Point back in the 60s when they designed the plant. And so sure enough, they didn't build it very well. And there's over 20 million people within 50 miles of Indian Point, so it's a tremendous risk.
How well are we in the U.S. prepared?
There's tremendous holes in emergency preparedness in the United States. And in fact, we've seen from documents released by the Freedom of Information Act that the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission time and time again downplays the risks. They operate in secrecy. They cover up when they can't get away with the secrecy. They minimize the dangers, and this is the agency that is supposed to protect public health and safety and the environment. But they busy themselves really with more of a PR mission to uphold the status and the reputation of the nuclear industry as well as that of their own agency. So when push comes to shove, we saw this at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, which is a highly technological society, probably the best prepared in the world for earthquakes and tsunamis. A total breakdown of emergency response and evacuations. And some people have heard about the Fukushima 50, and they think it refers to the workers who stood by their posts at Fukushima Daiichi, and they do deserve to be praised for their courage at a time of need. There's another Fukushima 50 that's much less known about, and those were the 50 elderly people and sick people who simply died because they were abandoned in the host town of Fukushima nuclear power plant when they were forgotten about during the evacuation. They simply perished, forgotten about. So if the United States thinks it's more prepared for a nuclear catastrophe than Japan, I'm afraid it has another thing coming. There's just breaking news from NBC.com today, again, on a Freedom of Information Act response that they finally got a hold of 3 years later from the NRC, that there was a lot of misleading going on. Specifically, the same reporter 3 years ago reported on the Indian Point seismic risks in New York City area based on NRC documents that were only 6 months old. They'd been published 6 months before the Fukushima catastrophe, and sure enough, it ranked Indian Point as the most at seismic risk in the country. The NRC Office of Public Affairs went very much out of its way to discredit that reporter, attacked that reporter, even to the point where other media outlets like the New York Times did not go forward with that data. That was NRC data. It had been publicly released. It was little known about, though. So the NRC does engage in misinformation and cover-up by attacking people who dare to even cite its own studies.
Are we being informed enough?
The American people had better wake up to these risks, because the supposedly assigned agency that's supposed to protect our health and safety is not doing so. They're completely captured by the industry. They're supposed to regulate. So it's up to us to protect ourselves, or the worst could happen here, just as it has in Japan. The people of Japan have been thrown on their own resources to deal with the aftermath of Fukushima, right down to radiation monitoring. And we're facing the same thing here. The emergency radiation monitoring set up by the U.S. federal government after Fukushima began was very quickly dismantled. So there's very little radiation monitoring going on, even of food contamination in the United States. Our standards are much weaker than Japan's.
We've been speaking with Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. This is David Lang with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, March 10th, 2014. Israeli soldiers killed two Palestinian men, one near the borders with Jordan and one near Ramallah. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers destroy farmlands near Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Monday evening, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian young man near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Israeli forces invaded the village of Bittin in near Ramallah, searched homes and fired live rounds at residents' homes. Saji Darwish, 20, was hit with a live round in his head. Medical sources announced that Darwish died instantly and was moved to Ramallah City Hospital. Earlier on Monday morning, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian man at the Allenby Bridge crossing with Jordan, Israel's army and witnesses said. An Israeli army spokeswoman claimed that the man attempted to seize the weapon of an Israeli soldier at the Allenby Bridge crossing with Jordan. The victim was identified as Raed Zaatari, 38, from Nablus. A Jordanian security official told AFP that Zaatar worked as a judge in Amman and had left for the West Bank early on Monday. The Palestinian Authority strongly condemned the incident and demanded international investigation into the circumstances of Zaatar's death. In other news, a Tel Aviv court on Monday sentenced a Palestinian Israeli with a 25 prison term over the 2012 bombing of a bus during a major Israeli campaign in Gaza. A resident of Taibe in central Israel, Mohammed Mafarjab, boarded the Tel Aviv bus on November 21, 2012 and placed a bomb inside before getting off, according to the district court. Shortly afterwards, it was triggered remotely by a cell phone being used by his accomplice, Ahmed Musa, a Palestinian from the occupied West Bank. Musa's trial is ongoing. The explosion wounded 24 people. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers invaded Palestinian farmlands in Al-Khadr town, south of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, and uprooted them. Moreover, Israeli settlers attacked on Monday private Palestinian farmland in Nabi Samuel to the northwest of Jerusalem. Israeli settlers from Har Samuel settlement cut off the fence surrounding the farmland and opened a new road through it, chopping down many trees and saplings, according to the farmland owner. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 10th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Dessam Bambura.
A prisoner exchange brokered by Qatar and Lebanon saw the release of over 150 female prisoners held by Assad's regime and 13 Syrian Greek Orthodox nuns held by Syrian rebel forces. Noting that they were allowed to continue wearing their crosses while held captive, the nuns described their captors as very sweet. The deal is a rarity, only one of only a handful brokered during the entire three-year civil war in Syria. Taliban forces in Afghanistan have threatened to attack anyone who goes near presidential polling booths in the upcoming elections there. The April 5th polling will see a change in the presidency as Hamid Karzai is barred from candidacy. The election, if successful, will be the first peaceful democratic transfer of power in Afghanistan.
The United States Senate tonight passed legislation toughening protections for victims of sexual assault in the military, after last week narrowly failing to pass legislation by New York State Senator Kirsten Gillibrand that would have taken the prosecution of such cases away from military personnel. The bill passed 97-0, would allow military victims of sexual assault the option to have their case heard in either the military tribunal system or in a civil court. It also allows a review when a commander declines to pursue an allegation brought by a prosecutor. Last Thursday, the Gillibrand bill's failure was accompanied by a grim item underscoring the military's problem with sexual abuse in its ranks. The same day the bill failed, it was reported the top Army sexual assault prosecutor, Lieutenant Colonel Jay Morris, had been accused of assault, which is said to have taken place at a conference about sexual assault 2 years ago. In addition, an Army general, Jeffrey Sinclair, is on trial in North Carolina and accused of sexual assault, and a sexual assault response coordinator in Fort Hood, Texas, has been accused of running a prostitution ring. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Terry Eaton, Robin Ryan, Rosalind Scott, David Lang, and Ginny Kanjis. The producer is Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Klepfer.
I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalist Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Urist hosts the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. In honor of Women's History Month, he'll be taking calls only from women callers. At 9, on Alternative Radio, journalist and writer Chris Hedges speaks on Captain Ahab and the U.S. Empire. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host DeMay Roberts speaks with Katie Lilyholm of the Well Arts Institute and writers Bonnie Littleton and Gary Gilbert about The Unexpected Guest, a new theater performance written by people living with multiple sclerosis. At 11:30 on Art Focus, host Eva Lake interviews Amy Bernstein, who has a show of paintings at National. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a member, why not become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today?
And stay tuned now for a live interview with Sadia Khan, conducted by KBOO reporters.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jo nahi mila, wo khwab hai. Aur jo mila, wo lajawab hai. The thing which you didn't get is a dream, and what you have right now is incredible.
Word shared from Sadia Khan. Sadia, where in Pakistan are you from?
Thank you for having me here. I'm working with Pakistani media industry. It's been like 11 years of experience of TV journalism and media and radio.
as well. I'm from Punjab, the biggest state of Pakistan, and I'm currently living in Lahore, that is the capital of Punjab.
So what is your field of study in the past or research that you're currently or have done in the past?
Okay, I've studied in journalism. I did my master's in journalism from the Punjab University, the biggest university of our country, in Punjab. Then I've started my career as intern from the news channel. It's the major news, private news channel of Pakistan, the Jio TV. And I started there as a researcher and coordinator. And then there was no looking back. I keep on working and working and working. It's like been 11 years of experience. And what now I'm emphasizing on is like something for the upcomers so that they may know how they should start their career in the media. Because in our times, we didn't have that chance. Our seniors never trained us about anything. They just gave us projects and just said, just go ahead and do it. So what I'm emphasizing is like make the less of lack of training. And secondly, give some secure type of atmosphere for the women to to encourage them to come out and to do work. I just want to thank and want to appreciate the ICFJ, International Center for Journalism, for giving us this opportunity. It's like we are like 20 journalism delegation of 20 journalists who are visiting US, and it's a very big step this time that we are visiting the areas of US which have never been heard. Whenever we are like talking about the US, whenever you are talking about like USA, it's only about Washington, or it's only about New York, or it's only about Chicago or Florida or Miami or San Diego Beach and this and that. When people never heard like Portland or Duluth or all the other areas. It's like a big opportunity, and they have taken a very big step. They have like sent all the 20 journalists in different far away cities of USA to get to know about these cities as well, and get the chance to know to let people know about the other picture of Pakistan also. ICFJ, International Center for Journalism, in collaboration with USEFP, they are like organizing this program.
And you're hoping to gain more information to train in the media of journalism. And you already have over a decade of experience as far as women and the working class of women that exists.
Well, when I have started my job in media, it was like a very, very, very few number of women who were working freely in this field, and they were like little empowered one. To gain this current position on which we are, we had worked hard. Not because only for ourselves, for all the other upcoming ladies as well. We have emphasized to give them like secure and safe atmosphere so that they must be encouraged. Even their families should be encouraged to let them come out and do some work and have their own identity. Nowadays, it's like very much different. Now it's a very different scenario in Pakistan as far as the women, working women are concerned. In Pakistani media is rapidly, it's like spreading very rapidly. Yes, I do consider that we have a very, very, very lack of training. Secondly, we don't have that chance how to cover and how to handle the breaking news. Yes, we do have the equipment. We do have like DSNGs, and we do have breaking news. As you all know, we are having a lot of breaking news from Pakistan, all over the world. But now we don't know how to handle it, how to tackle that news. And this is also like losing little credibility as well. because people are like a little annoyed. Well, it's like the same in US, I think, as well. Some of the channels are in US as well are doing the same, that they are, every news is like breaking news. People are get annoyed. They are like creating panic in the people. There is a large number of women, not only in a media industry, there's a large number of women in every part of life. They are working, and they are working very practically, and they are working very actively. And now scenario has been changed. Just like me, so many of the women are on like major posts, are controlling so many things, and like in charge of so many of things. I'll put something here as well as like example. This is the biggest example of women empowerment. Like this is the first batch of ICFJ with 20 journalists. First of all, it's the biggest group who has come to US. Second one, it's the first one who is having 11 media persons which are women, and only 9 of them are men. So it's a big, you know, change of scenario. It can like show you a different picture of Pakistani women as well. Apart from that, you know, Pakistani area which is having some problem, there are like so many other parts in which you can see women and men are equally working, and working very beautifully. And now it's like a time in also in Pakistan as well that man has no other choice but to give space to the woman and give the way to the woman to have their own space of work and to like go.
Right. And with the big responsibilities, we're trying to tackle big challenges.
Yeah, big, very big challenges. You know, Warren, instead of men, I don't know it'll be offensive or not, but I always found working ladies more hardworking than men. They are like, women are more committed to their work, except men. I don't know how you'll take it, but this is what I feel. This is what I saw while working in my media, in my surroundings. That women are more hardworking. They know how to tackle the situations. They know how to work in like intense situations as well. Now, it's not like that in Pakistan. If there is a bomb blast, or there is something else, or there is like flood, or there is we are facing earthquake or something, then women won't go there. They will like ignore the situations and will prefer to be back in office. No, it's not like that. I myself covered Benazir assassination. I myself covered Marriott blast, so many other blasts. I myself covered Lal Masjid operation. I was physically present at the earthquake areas and the flood relief areas. And when we were having like Sawat operation, I myself was there. In fact, when we had GHQ bomb blast, I was like 5 months pregnant. I was expecting my first baby, but still I was in the field and I was doing work.
That's very inspiring to hear, because there is a legacy of her history, which has existed with women having come together and pick up where we are needed to help out.
Yeah.
And that's great to hear.
Yes.
And also,
now I'm having like, I'm the mother of two. 4 years and 2 years, two boys, but still I'm managing to have them as well and to have my job as well. I know how to manage. And of course, with the help of my family, with the support of my husband, without their support and without their, like, if they are there, without their support and help, I can't even think about it. But now, as the time has changed, so they are always there to help me out. Even my in-laws, even my father-in-law, my mother-in-law, they completely understand the situation. They always help me out to look after the babies or the situations or anything else. And they always help me out. In fact, they used to encourage me. And they are like, it's a change of time that they are quite much proud of me. So the time has changed.
When you go back to Pakistan, will it just be focused on you training future journalists? Or will you guys be having certain stories that you want to investigate in Pakistan? Do you have any investigative journalists?
Yeah, we do have investigative journalists in Pakistan whom they investigate about a specific story. But there is something different from U.S. journalism and Pakistani journalism. In Pakistan, if we are investigating on a story or something, we'll report it in a day or so. But in U.S., I heard, if you are investigating on a story, you are always have the chance to take your time to research about it very well and get the know about it, again, know how about it, investigate it completely, perfectly before making it and on airing it or publishing this story. In Pakistan, there is a need. Yes, on our way back in Pakistan, we want to change it a little bit. We want a change in investigative stories that we should have some more time to investigate a story, to get the authentic information, and to change basically to change the investigative journalism tools.
Changing the tools. Right.
Changing the tools.
So what tools specifically would you want to see changed?
The research, authentic information, the research, and the ethics as well. Ethic of journalism should be there while investigating a story. And if you are getting some information from any source, it should be authentic. And you should take some more time to investigate it. Otherwise, I don't think so. It'll be more fair to just be in a hurry and just file your story or publish your story without the enough research work.
Well, I'd like to thank you for letting me talk to you and ask in questions about who you are and giving us insight into how the political arena is expanding and growing, and we hope to be hearing more from you
in the next coming days. Yes, I'm here. Hello, Portland. I'm in Portland for a month, and you will be hearing a lot from me in the coming days. So get ready.
Very nice to have a woman's voice coming from Pakistan.
And we are very much happy to be here and to express our views and to show you a Pakistani woman picture in front of you. And we are happy to do this. We'll be sharing our experiences with you, and we'll be hearing your experiences for our training as well.
That's the voice of KBOO's visiting journalist Sadia Khan. Khan currently lives and works in her home city of Lahore, Pakistan, the capital of the Pakistani province of Punjab. Previously, she worked for 7 years in Islamabad, covering the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, multiple bomb blasts, earthquakes, and floods. She joined the KBOO newsroom today, Monday, March 10th, and will be at the station until March 31st. KBOO will host a free community forum where Ms. Sadia Khan will discuss her pioneering work in Pakistani media on Thursday, March 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the station located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, one half block south of Burnside. The time is 6:03 and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30 it will be Prison Pipeline, so please stay tuned.
KBOO is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
KABU is a proud media co-sponsor of March Music Modern 4 for 2014. Listening to the Here of the Now. Beginning Friday, March 3rd, and running through Sunday, March 16th, 32 events, 20th and 21st century music, concerts, movies, and more. Music by composers from near and far, performed by both local and internationally acclaimed musicians at a variety of venues throughout Portland. Many of these events are free. That's March Music Modern. More information at the KABU homepage under Community Events or at marchmusicmodern.org.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
So this is KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM, and up next is Labor Radio. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability,